Chapter 21. Romilius, I pray for you and for our Lord Jesus. I hold you both in my heart and trust that your plan will succeed. Nobody must ever know, so I am unhappy at telling Petros, but you have commanded it and I must obey. From what you've told me, I understand that should Pontius Pilate be forced against his will to sentence Jesus to death, you will be in charge of the execution detail. If this happens, you will see to the crucifixion of our Lord and Master, but you will do your utmost to have the body taken down before he is dead. To do this, you will use Passover as an excuse. You might even be forced to give the master a slight wound, but you will not carry out the final breaking of legs, as is the custom. The thought of what could occur fills me with horror. Even speaking of it to Petros makes me tremble. If this has to happen, when you take Jesus down from the cross, you will hand his body to the man from Arimathea, Joseph, who together with Mary, Jesus' mother, and one of his messengers called John, will take him away for burial in Joseph's own tomb, which is prepared. Later you will return to the burial place under cover of darkness, with two of Joseph's most trusted men, who will be needed to roll away the stone that seals the tomb. Jesus will then be taken secretly to the Essenes, who live together as a family by the Dead Sea. These good people will nurse Jesus back to health and keep him close to them for as long as is necessary. Jesus has not been told of this plan, nor will he be told of it. Charlie Gauntlet gave a long sigh. If this document was real, and if it was a mirror reflection of the events in Palestine 2,000 years ago, then a huge cornerstone of the Christian faith could be hauled into a new doubt. If these words were true, if they were dictated by this woman living in Jerusalem at the time of the crucifixion, if the centurion Romilius was the officer in charge of the barbaric execution, and if he had brought Jesus down from the cross before he was dead, then the mystery of the resurrection was suspect. Many in the 20th century had found the resurrection difficult enough to swallow. Now, with the coming of Naomi's diary, the atheists would have a field day. A lot of ifs, he thought, remembering a passage from one of the Gospels, the bit about a soldier piercing Jesus' side with a spear. He clearly recalled the words, "And forthwith came there out blood and water." Back when he thought about these things, Charlie had felt this was one of the small details, adding a patina of truth to the story of the crucifixion and resurrection. Now, if the reason for it was to demonstrate falsely that Jesus was dead, it altered a massive thrust of history. If Naomi's spoken diary was proved to be dependable, then people had no need to make a leap of faith to find God. The whole idea of the resurrection was blown away. These thoughts disturbed Charlie, who could not help thinking that, if it were so, then the monastic order of St. Jerome, indeed, no Christian community or congregation, would be happy about this document going into the public domain. Their assignment would rather be to prove that the document was suspect, even fraudulent. He paced the cell, turning every four strides, his brow wrinkling, feeling the first twitch of a headache, far away but coming closer just between the eyes. He pushed roughly at the door, and to his surprise it swung open, so that he could walk into the cloister and head toward Father Gregory Scott's study. It was cold, damp, and blustery, and as he rounded the corner, Charlie saw Bex, and could hardly believe it was her. At first he did not recognize her, because he had never conceived of her in this setting. It was a total surprise. His brain said, "It can't be her," while his instincts told him it was. And it was true, there was Bex, half running, looping toward him, head back, and a raincoat wrapped around her, insubstantial in the chill of the morning. He thought it was a dream or a hallucination. "I'm imagining it," he said to himself. "This can't be real." Then they ran toward each other, like Hollywood lovers meeting in a great reunion scene at the end of a film, embracing and hugging close, Charlie lifting her from the ground for a second, smelling the scent of her and the sweetness of her hair, feeling the familiar flesh under the raincoat. Then he kissed her, an imitation of penetration. He tasted the salt of her tears and the clean, minty toothpaste, then he pulled away. "How in heaven's name? You'd better come," she brimmed full of happiness, her eyes damp. "You'd better come and listen. Patsy's doing the honours. Patsy? Patsy Wright? Patsy's here. We came to collect you. Joe Bain was alarmed and not a happy man. We've been running an op here. Grabbing at his arm, a little like a child, hanging on, almost swinging. Patsy saved my bacon in Switchback Land, but I think he's got a hidden agenda. Usually has. A long intake of breath, a gulp of air. Crikey, I've missed you, Bex. She told him that she loved him and clung even harder. She's worried, he thought to himself. Come to that, I'm worried. These monks are bloody weird. Patsy Wright was leaning over Father Gregory's right shoulder, looking at something as they entered the study. Patsy glanced up, a little guiltily, Charlie thought, until he saw the others ranged around the room. Fathers Harry and Hugh, with Kit Palfrey sitting on a carved high-backed chair in the corner. The chair could have been made for Richard III. Charlie thought the head of a wild boar was carved in the centre of the tall back. Words sidled through his head. The cat, the rat, and Lovell, our dog, rule all England under a hog. Richard III's emblem was a wild boar. My mind is stuffed with trivia, Charlie thought, and recalled a schoolmaster's report that said, the boy has a ragbag mind. Charlie, Patsy framed it as a question. Charlie, you okay? Charlie shrugged, cold but mild-mannered as ever. What's going on, Patsy? Charlie saw that Patsy had one hand resting on Gregory Scott's shoulder in a kind of proprietary way. Still the same old Patsy, the toughened steel hand in the serviceable white cotton gloves. You shouldn't be here, Charlie. Patsy squinted upward, head still turned toward the pages on the desk. How the hell did you... I persuaded him. Kit Palfrey spoke softly from his corner, as though he had a lot more to say. Persuaded him against his will, really. Used him. There were reasons. You should have known better, Kit. This is a bloody minefield. Sorry, Padre. Padres. Patsy corrected himself, his deceptively gentle face smiling at the two studious monks, Harry and Hugh. They beamed back as though pleased to be included. Neither spoke, but that was their way. And for a second Charlie wondered at the buzz these two men of God got from delving into the past, reading old manuscripts, translating not just words, but tenets of faith. Gregory Scott smiled a distant smile, but did not even turn his head. Why is it a minefield, Patsy? Charlie asked. In his experience with Patsy Wright, a conversation like this was really to inform those who listened, rather than to exchange knowledge. This time Patsy Wright raised his head and looked directly at Charlie. Did you ever know anything infested by the likes of Kit Palfrey that wasn't a minefield, Charles? You know everything he's touched in the past 3 decades has turned to dross. That's not fair, Patsy. Palfrey spoke out of the corner of his mouth, like an old lag in a prison yard, or a bad ventriloquist. He appeared to be genuinely hurt by what Patsy had said. What's not fair, Kit? Patsy's tone changed to gruff and stormy. What's not fair? Bringing Charlie here to vouch for something he knows damn all about? Letting him wear government colours when he's no right? Warn them before? Palfrey began. But not any more, you slimy little man. You had no right. It's like dragging a blind man into the middle of Regent Street in Russia. Charlie's not briefed, has no idea what we're up against. Patsy stopped as though lost for words, one hand raised, the fist clenched, bawled. He turned back to Gauntlet. You know what's going on, Charlie? Not the foggiest, Patsy, but there, you see? Swiveling at the hips, turning to face Bex in the corner, the priest's heads turned as if they were watching a game of tennis. But I can hazard a guess, Charlie said. Well, guess away, old love, because I reckon this is the original tangled web we weaved and deceived with. For a second, Charlie felt like an escapee trapped in the cone of a searchlight in a minefield. Okay. He looked around the room. Okay, I'll have a stab at unravelling it. First off, I think the good Father Superior's been in bed with the wrong people. Gregory Scott began to splutter. Oh, Gregory, I didn't mean literally in bed. Well, possibly some 50 years ago. Charlie let the idea hang in the air like smoke. Father Gregory simply looked away and shook his head. You want to tell us about it? After all, you started to tell me, I think.